You are listening to 93.3 FM WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. Coming up next to show the NSA always loves to listen into and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning. The views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show, do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's hosts.
Guess who's back again.
Mike Cannon.
This is my boomstick!
This could be dangerous. You should go back.
I know you're out there. I can feel it now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. You're afraid of us.
But we're going to kick things off with Glenn Beck being signed by the Fox News Network.
Glenn, it's Sean. You've been made. Right. Welcome to the family, Glenn.
Thank you, Fox Father. Thank you.
Oi.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Each and every week, we try to bring you alternative voices from around the country and the world. Voices the six mega corporations that control 90% of all television, newsprint, and radio do not want you to know about. The goal of the Mike Cannon Show is to offer these voices to you. It is obvious, if you ever listen to this show, that media just does not tell you the whole story, or even the truth for that matter. Our goal is to try to change that. I'd like to welcome two stations that started to air parts of my little ditty each week, both from blogtalkradio.org, Rabble Raising Radio, and Radio Free Kansas. With all these downloads and kind notes I've been receiving, it has been time for me to evaluate the service to you. I had a comment from a friend that he liked my music a lot and would like to hear more of it. I also had a comment from a conservative friend of mine that a lot of what he hears on my show is a downer to him. He'd like something more cheery. I do try to break up some of the shorter shows with a little bit of fun here or there, like the comedy piece Heads Up. But I find it hard to figure out what to include or what not to include in my show. There's so much good stuff out there. The truth of the matter is that this is a project of love of mine that takes many, many hours to produce. This week in Radical History alone, I can spend up to 5 hours putting together. I'm not complaining, it's just that I feel that all these great shows out there deserve their own time in the light, too, for all the efforts that they put into it. And getting the truth out beyond the big corporate filter is tough. So I dedicate this show to finding good, often great shows. My other hope is to offer this 3 to 4 hour show each week, up for rebroadcast on alternative stations who recognize the great material out there, but don't have the time to put it all together themselves. This show tries to put it all in one place, so even if they don't air my show, they'll know what else is out there. That being said, I'm always open to suggestions. Consider dropping me a line at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Cannon is spelled C-A-N-N-O-N. That's all one long run-on word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. I'd like to take another moment out of my day here to talk a little more about what you can normally hear on the show. This show is produced for other not-for-profit community and micropower radio use. Some stations air part of my show. Other stations may or may not know what I normally offer. I'd like to mention some of those shows here. The first hour normally always includes a great weekly roundup of news items from the previous week from the great work done at the people at Eat the State. I also try to include in the first hour Women's E-News information about women's concerns and other short pieces I can fit into the first hour of the show. The second hour always starts out with an LGBT news advocacy magazine called This Way Out. I'll then try to fit in some shorter great material that could not fit in the first hour, like Peak Oil Check-In, Ask Mr. Green, that type of eco-news programming. Also, shorter radio spin and media minutes is included in the first or second hour, depending upon where I could fit it in. The third hour will feature This Week in Palestine, giving the listeners a chance to hear some news reports produced out of Palestine from a non-Zionist, non-corporate point of view, and or Scooter and his Interside Radio programming, which offers a little humor later in the show. So that is a typical lineup you get each week on the Mike Cannon Show. Often, unless I have something very spectacular or I have a lot of time on my hands, which is very seldom since it takes quite a long time to produce this show, I will loop the first hour and the fourth hour of my show. So if you're listening on WNRB LP in Wausau, Wisconsin, This week, as in most weeks, you can expect to hear the first hour of the show again repeated on the fourth hour. Again, I am always curious if anyone has any suggestions about how to make the show better. And please feel free to contact me if you do at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. So let's get back into this week's show. The normal fare, the normal lineup I mentioned earlier that you get to hear this week. I hope you enjoy this little effort to get news the corporations do not cover and to introduce to you nonprofit, often community radio stations at its best. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening.
There it is, right above the McCain-Palin sign, a makeshift ghost hanging from a noose, a Barack Obama sign attached upside down, Obama's middle name Hussein spray-painted and misspelled above. Mike Lunsford hung the ghost in his yard. He spoke to us off-camera saying his views could hurt his employer's business, but he also says, make no mistake, he doesn't want an African-American running the country. Lunsford says he believes Barack Obama is not a full-blooded American. And he says the United States is a white Christian nation, and only white Christians should be in power.
As a cold political calculation, I could not be more pleased. She has excited and energized our base. She is a direct counterpoint to the liberal feminist agenda for America.
General Paul Asher, you gave a campaign contribution to Senator McCain. You have met twice at least with Barack Obama. Are you prepared to make a public declaration of which of these two candidates that you're prepared to support?
Yes, but let me lead in with this way. I have some concerns about the direction that the party has taken in recent years. It has moved more to the right than I would like to see it, but that's a choice the party makes. I have especially watched over the last 6 or 7 weeks, and I must say that I've gotten a good measure of both. In the case of Mr. McCain, I found that he was a little unsure as to how to deal with the economic problems that we were having. And almost every day there was a different approach to the problem, and that concerned me. It's got the sensing that he didn't have a complete grasp of the economic problems that we had. And I was also concerned at the selection of Governor Palin. She's a very distinguished woman, and she's to be admired. But at the same time, now that we have had a chance to watch her for some 7 weeks, I don't believe she's ready to be President of the United States, which is the job of the Vice President. And so that raised some question in my mind as to the judgment that Senator McCain made. I also believe that on the Republican side, over the last 7 weeks, the approach of the Republican Party and Mr. McCain has become narrower and narrower. And I've also been disappointed, frankly, by some of the approaches that Senator McCain has taken recently, or his campaign has, on issues that are not really central to the problems that the American people are worried about. This Bill Ayers situation that's been going on for weeks became something of a central point of the campaign. But Mr. McCain says that he's a washed-out terrorist. But then why do we keep talking about him? And why do we have these robocalls going on around the country trying to suggest that because of this very, very limited relationship that Senator Obama has had with Mr. Ayers, somehow Mr. Obama is tainted? What they're trying to connect him to is some kind of terrorist feelings. And I think that's inappropriate. But I think this goes too far. And I think it has made the McCain campaign look a little narrow. It's not what the American people are looking for. And I look at these kinds of approaches to the campaign, and they trouble me. And the party has moved even further to the right, and Governor Palin has indicated a further rightward shift. I would have difficulty with two more conservative appointments to the Supreme Court, but that's what we'd be looking at in a McCain administration. I'm also troubled by not what Senator McCain says, but what members of the party say. And it is permitted to be said such things as, well, you know that Mr. Obama is a Muslim. Well, the correct answer is he is not a Muslim. He's a Christian. He's always been a Christian. But the really right answer is, what if he is? Is there something wrong with being a Muslim in this country? The answer is no, that's not America. Is there something wrong with some 70-year-old Muslim American kid believing that he or she could be president? Yet I have heard senior members of my own party drop this suggestion. He's a Muslim and he might be associated with terrorists. This is not the way we should be doing it in America. I feel strongly about this particular point because of a picture I saw in a magazine. It was a photo essay about troops who were serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And one picture at the tail end of this photo essay was of a mother in Arlington Cemetery. And she had her head on the headstone of her son's grave. And as the picture focused in, you could see the writing on the headstone. And it gave his awards, Purple Heart, Bronze Star, showed that he died in Iraq, gave his date of birth, his date of death. He was 20 years old. And then at the very top of the headstone, it didn't have a Christian cross. It didn't have a Star of David. It had a crescent and a star of the Islamic faith. And his name was Karim Rashad Sultan Khan. And he was an American. He was born in New Jersey. He was 14 years old at the time of 9/11. And he waited until he can go serve his country, and he gave his life. Now, we have got to stop polarizing ourselves in this way. But I'm troubled about the fact that within the party, we have these kinds of expressions.
That guy gets elected, he hangs around with terrorists.
Who's the terrorist?
Obama. Obama's a terrorist, don't you know that?
Obama's a Muslim, he's a terrorist himself. Commie faggot!
Socialist swine.
Screw Obama! Boo! European socialist!
You think they should...
Bill Ayers, you scumbag!
You think they should die, sir?
Everyone dies, don't they?
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
It is 8:33, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. How about that economy?
Yeah. Well, no. This has kind of been the week when after the week before when we saw the stock market go up and then down and then back up and then way down. This is the week people have been talking about confidence and trying to get people to understand that confidence is key to the functioning of markets. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about confidence in terms that you haven't heard this week, terms that you're not going to hear from economists and other analysts. So I'm just going to talk for a second about confidence and the credit market and banks. Well, once upon a time, banks were private companies in the U.S. Before 1970, banks were owned by partnerships. They were not allowed to sell their stock on the stock market. After 1970, banks were allowed to go public and sell shares. Well, this allowed them to raise lots of money with stock offerings, and they could then borrow a lot of money. They could run up their debt and then use that money to loan out to people. What that did is it made this big expansion of credit possible. And it boosted growth in the economy as a whole. But there's a downside to this. When banks have stock that can be bought and sold on the market, then their stock price becomes a daily vote of confidence from shareholders as to whether that bank is a worthy investment and whether it is credit worthy and whether or not it's a good bank for customers to take their and put their money in. So when the stock price goes down, then customers start thinking, maybe I ought to take my money out, and there can be runs on the bank. Lenders, other banks that have loaned money to that bank, start to get nervous, and they stop wanting to loan money to that bank, and they start wanting to call in their debts. So even though a bank may have a lot of assets, like we've seen, in the recent past, Lehman Brothers had a lot of assets on its balance sheet that were considered valuable at the time that it collapsed. We see those banks still failing, and it's primarily because they are publicly traded companies on the stock market, and when their stock price goes down, it becomes difficult for them to continue their business. And so we see other big banks and other big finance companies fighting over banks failing when, in fact, they probably should not necessarily have been failing. So, for example, you see Citigroup and Wells Fargo fighting over who gets to buy Wachovia, which is a bank that's been in trouble in the last couple of weeks. So that's a part of the whole confidence argument that you're not going to hear really from economists, that banks being publicly traded companies now are very, 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 very sensitive to the confidence of shareholders. So let's talk a little bit about average people, you and me, and confidence. People like you and me, a lot of Americans, make a very key mistake. We look at the stock investments that we own, and we think of that as cash in our pockets. And that, therefore, gives us the confidence to go out and borrow a lot of money. So we might charge up a lot of stuff on our credit cards, or we might take out a home equity line of credit, thinking that we have a lot of investments that we could sell if we need to in order to pay off our debts. Wrong. That is so very wrong. People should be looking at their stock investments not as cash in their pockets, but as a potential cash in their pocket, something that you look at as for the future, somewhere down the line. It's not like cash in the bank. And what people do then, having stock investments, they think, well, you know, my stock investments are worth a lot. I can borrow a lot of money then and spend a lot. So it gives them false confidence in their actual worth. So what people don't think about is, yeah, sure, the stock market goes up, but there are times when the stock market goes down, when the potential of what you could get out of your stock investments is not high. Sometimes when the stock market goes down, the potential goes down. But it really should have no impact, really, on your personal finances at the time if you're doing the right thing, which is investing only money you can spare in the stock market, and you're doing it only for a long period of time. You're looking at a long time horizon. Well, then people make a second very key mistake, which is they borrowed money thinking that their debts are future problems, not cash out of their pocket right now, when in fact people should be looking at the credit card balance as that's money out of my pocket right now. Because literally is, the next time you make a payment on your credit card, you have to make payments of interest on money that you borrowed. That is money out of your pocket right now. It's not a future problem, not something you should be ignoring, like you should be ignoring your investments in the stock market. Most people open up their account statements from their stock market investments and they go, wow, look at this, cash in my pockets, it's doing so well. They look at those every month and they feel happy about it, when they should be shoving them in a drawer and looking at them maybe once a year. They should be ignoring that, thinking that's long term, that's for somewhere out in the future. And they take their credit card statements, they open them up and they look at the balance and they cringe and they go, oh, I don't even want to think about it. They make the minimum payment on their credit card and then they shove the credit card statement in the drawer and forget about it. They do the opposite with their credit card statement of what they should be doing. They should be looking at it going, how can I pay this off as soon as possible? Because this is money out of my pocket right now. So that's a big part of the problem. And the reason people do this, I think, primarily is because they get all the encouragement that they can, that, you know, you get all the encouragement to do this that's possible from the finance industry. They really push you to do this. They push you to borrow money, and they push you to make investments in the stock market and to consider those investments as cash now when they really are not. So that's one of the big problems with what's going on right now. So when you see the stock market fall, it's not surprising then that you see people start to panic and go, oh my God, I have so much debt, now I don't have any cash to pay it off, and look, my investments are falling, that's cash out of my pocket, et cetera, et cetera. I have to sell now in order to get what I can out of it to pay off my debts. And they do exactly the wrong thing. They sell when the potential return from their stock investments is extremely low. So you see people doing the absolutely wrong thing at the wrong time. So that's a big part of what's going on with the stock market. But there are other problems, too, as to why the stock market's reeling. It's going to be volatile. If you remember a couple of weeks ago when I said it's difficult to make predictions about the future, but one thing we know is that markets are going to continue to be volatile. Well, the stock market is going to continue to do what it's been doing the last couple of weeks, as long as there's the perception that no one is taking responsibility for the problem and trying to fix it. Right now, George Bush is AWOL. He not only doesn't understand the problem, he doesn't understand the magnitude of the problem. His Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, can't seem to get his arms around it. And he and Ben Bernanke, the head of the Fed, they're both perceived as having major conflicts of interest since they both come out of the very industry they're trying to rescue and regulate.
And in Paulson's case, he's about to go back into it in a couple months.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And in Europe right now, bankers and heads of state are getting together to do major rescues of the European financial system. that makes ours look just very pale by comparison. And you have to consider that the U.S. is the place where the problem began, and we're not doing nearly enough. I just want to run a few numbers for you. In order to recapitalize U.S. banks, the U.S. government would not have to spend $250 billion buying stock as they've proposed, but should really spend somewhere between $1 to $2 trillion in stock purchases. And they shouldn't be buying non-voting shares. They should be buying voting shares and taking a controlling interest in these banks in order to help regulate the problem.
In other words, nationalize them.
Yeah, just like is happening in much of Europe. The Treasury has proposed insuring deposits up to $250,000, but that's only for the next 3 months. Get it? Only until George Bush is going to be leaving office. So that's not spurring much confidence in investors and in depositors. There's only $45 billion in the Federal Deposit Insurance Fund run by the FDIC, the fund that's used to cover people's deposits when a bank fails. However, there's an estimated $5.2 trillion worth of insured deposits in banks in the United States, and Congress has done nothing yet to boost the amount of money in the Deposit Insurance Fund. And I just want to point out that with the failure of IndyMac Bank in July, IndyMac was a medium-sized regional bank, there were around $1 billion in uninsured deposits when that bank failed. So a big bank failure could mean a major draw on the insurance fund. So until things are done to help with these kinds of problems here in the U.S., you're going to continue to see a lot of volatility and a lot of problems in the stock market and in the credit markets.
All right. Moving on, Job, you want to mention Iraq very briefly, or would you rather jump
to events? Just a few things. We haven't talked about Iraq in a couple weeks. A draft proposal has been leaked out as to the security agreement that the Bush administration is trying to negotiate with al-Maliki's government in Iraq before Bush leaves office. That agreement apparently does include a concession that the Bush administration has been very resistant to, which is a date for U.S. withdrawal. That date is the end of 2011, 3 years from now, as opposed to the 16 months that Barack Obama has been promising, should he get into office. So, and there is a widespread opposition to this agreement in Iraq itself. Maliki has said that any agreement would have to pass the Iraqi parliament, which seems dubious. There was a protest of some 100,000 people in Baghdad yesterday opposing the agreement, a protest, by the way, that got almost no media attention in the U.S. And also, just to flag, don't count on the victory of the surge just yet. Patrick Coburn with a report last week in the Independent of Britain saying that cholera is once again a problem in Iraq, and a new national intelligence estimate this month saying that a lot could still go wrong in Iraq, and not to count your victory chickens before they have hatched.
Yeah, and the main problem appears to be a growing possibility of a civil war in Iraq.
Right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchuk, both with Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
Every second as we are seated here, a child is going to die as a result of hunger somewhere in the world.
These alarming words from Ben Mailer, chief executive producer at United Nations Radio. At no time since Francis Moore Pape wrote the bestseller Diet for a Small Planet in 1971 has the food situation been so dire for humanity. Raj Patel is a fellow at Food First and says that the current crisis is the result of 30 years of misguided agricultural and food policies.
Haiti was forced to adopt these structural adjustment policies that the World Bank... Now, U.S. rice farmers get $1 billion a year in subsidy. That is what Haitian farmers had to compete with. At the beginning of the 1980s, Haiti grew the majority of its own rice. But by the end of the 1990s, and in fact as recently as last month, there were food riots in Haiti. Not over Haitian rice that came in a big bag with the American flag on it and the words, "Gift of the People of the United States."
As nearly 40 million will experience hunger in the United States this year, the treatment of food as a mere commodity is creating a health crisis, with obesity and diabetes reaching epidemic proportions. According to Ben Burkett, a Mississippi farmer and director of the National Family Farm Coalition,
the crisis is a direct result of the industrialization in every region of the world, which drive out rural workers, destroy biodiversity and the environment, and the result is hunger and poverty. But the crisis can be overcome if we abandon this model.
John Kinsman, a Wisconsin organic farmer, believes food growing is a communal affair.
There are models that work. The peasants and the indigenous peoples of the global south have for thousands of years maintained the biodiversity and kept the land enriched and passed it on for generations. We owe them a tremendous debt.
Food distribution workers also have a stake in food quality. Pat Purcell from the United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 1500, says good food, good jobs, and good health are the building blocks for a sustainable society.
New York City has lost hundreds of its supermarkets, replaced with 800 drugstores, 10,000 bodegas, Starbucks, Blockbusters. There are only 550 full-service supermarkets.
While drugs and alcohol sales are thriving, fresh organic food is virtually unknown in poor and minority neighborhoods. In Berkeley, California, Alice Waters, chef and owner of Chez Panisse, founded Edible Schoolyard at the Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School, where food growing and preparation is now a part of the curriculum.
This could be in every school in this country. Edible education taught every child the lasting values of care for the land, of nourishment, and communication with others. That's the only way we're going to share this planet, this very precious planet.
Listeners can sign on to the call to action to end the food crisis at usfoodcrisisgroup.org.
Would that make the world more beautiful? No, no. Would it stop with the war? Would it teach us more about life? No, no, no. One day we'll be one.
For the WBI Sunday News, this is Fred Nguyen.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. GM announced on Thursday it plans to cut 1,500 more jobs, 400 in Delaware, 700 in Michigan. The three plants being targeted for those cuts produce large sedans and pickups. The automobile industry saw its sharpest decline in 17 years during September as sales plummeted 27%.
GM is in serious discussions with the owners of Chrysler, talking about a possible merger.
PepsiCo announced on Tuesday that it plans to cut 3,300 jobs and close six plants. The company, which is the world's number two drink producer, plans to make the cuts both in and outside the United States. Announcements as to which plants will be shuttered will be made in the coming months. Dr. James Parrott of New York's Fiscal Policy Institute says that a new study by the Center for Economic Policy Research reveals that median wages for young U.S. workers today are lower than 30 years ago. Unions, Parrott says, raise those wages by an average of 13%.
Unions make an important difference in the compensation and the pay and benefits that young workers receive.
Acorn says while individuals it hired may have turned in false voter registrations, Acorn itself is not falsifying voter registrations as portrayed by John McCain's campaign and some corporate media reports. Acorn's Austin King says the vast majority of Acorn's 1.3 million new voter registrations are legitimate and will give low-income voters a real voice.
This was a phenomenal effort that has made our voter rolls look more like America, and because of that, the electorate that shows up on November 4th will look more like America.
The United Steelworkers gave GOP Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin the reception she deserved at a Republican fundraiser in Pittsburgh. Jesse Russell has the story.
We are the Union! We are the Union! The mighty, mighty Union!
The United Steelworkers joined with several other unions in downtown Pittsburgh on Friday to drive home the message that Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin doesn't represent union workers, even if her husband Todd is a card-carrying union member. The VP pick has used her husband's steelworker membership to try and win over blue-collar workers that may traditionally be less inclined to vote for a Republican. Palin was in Pittsburgh on Friday for a $1,000 per plate fundraiser, and the steelworkers said they led the march from their office to the Weston Convention Center so she could meet the union that represents her husband.
We think it's kind of ironic that although she and Todd run around the country bragging about being steelworkers and about their great union benefits, they didn't even have the time to come over and say hello to all the people that work hard for them every day.
400 professors are calling on California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to reverse his line item veto hit job on the University of California's Labor Studies program. Chris Tilley is director of UCLA's Institute for Research on Labor and Employment.
There was only one thing that he vetoed out of $3.3 billion in programs. He vetoed one $6 million program, and so we have to conclude that this is politically targeted.
Workers Independent News, we can review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
And now, the only radio commentator not addicted to illegal pain medication, nor Viagra, Mike Cannon.
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
My thanks to Mike Cannon at WNRB in Wausau, Wisconsin, who rebroadcast World Report.
Welcome to Media Minutes. Welcome to the weekly radio spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of cheap oil.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives. From the weekly Cheers...
This Week in Radical History for the week of April 7th.
My name is Scooter, and this is the Inner Side Radio Program.
This Week in Palestine, the service of the International Middle East Media Center. I am Ian.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out on WNRB, Wausau, Wisconsin.
All these programs and more can be heard each week on the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m., right here on Central Wisconsin's only non-corporate, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau. Free people, free radio.
Women's E-News, weekly summary of news about women, women's issues, and from women's perspectives, from the weekly Cheers and Jeers column of October 18, 2008. I'm Anna Maria Roque. Starting with the good news, Cheers! Catholics urge for rights. Catholic women march in Rome to denounce the church's ban against female priests. In May, the Vatican reiterated its stance against female ordination and said that women who take part will be excommunicated. At the Women's Ordination Conference held in Rome this week, activists urged the church to recognize women's prominent leadership roles in the Bible, and that excluding women from church decisions has been devastating to public policy regarding women's issues. More news to cheer this week. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon announced that the UN is quadrupling its effort to end obstetric fistula, a severe injury that develops in childbirth, leaving many women incontinent. At least 2 million women are affected, but most fistulas can be repaired with adequate medical care. The Kapchorwa district in eastern Uganda has banned the deeply rooted cultural practice of female circumcision. The local district council also submitted legislation to parliament to create a national ban. First ladies from 7 Western African countries, Benin, Burkina Faso, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Mali, Niger, and Togo, are meeting on October 20th to address how to end the practice in Africa. For the first time in Turkey's history, a picture of a woman, novelist Fatma Aliyeh, will appear on a banknote when the new Turkish lira is issued in January of 2009. Volleyball coach Jay Flood and golf coach Holly Vaughn received $3.4 million from Florida Gulf Coast University to settle a case in which they claimed they have been retaliated against for complaints of sex discrimination in school athletic programs. The 2008 Africa Prize for Leadership for Sustainable End of Hunger was shared among 5 women. Co-founder of African Women's Development Fund in Ghana, Bisi Adelie Fayima, Christine Aknela Menza-Tom, founder of the theater group to change attitudes towards girls and women in Togo, Kenyan women rights activist Faisha Mohammed, Chilo Motsai, a South African counselor, and Janet Kuana, who gathered Hutu and Tutsi women in Rwanda as a force for peace-building and economic development. Carol Rivers, a Women's E-News columnist and member of the Board of Directors, received the Helen Thomas Award for Lifetime Achievement from the Society of Professional Journalists. Rivers, a professor at Boston University, has covered politics, the media, race and gender for national publications since the early 1960s. Now for the downside of news. Cheers! Israel's Livni is snubbed. Ultra-Orthodox Israeli newspapers have banned photographs of Tzipi Livni, elected by her party to become Israel's next prime minister, in their political coverage because she is a woman. This week, leaders of United Torah Judaism Party said they might not join a government coalition if Livni is the head. Livni is expected to become the Israeli leader when she negotiates a coalition government. But United Torah Judaism member Rabbi Joseph Shalom Elashif said his party has not made a final decision about whether it will join, which could prove crucial to Livni's ability to stay in power. He said, quote, "It is not simple to sit in a government when the prime minister is a woman." the ultra-Orthodox form 12% of the Israeli population and hold significant political power. Over the past 2 years, women accused of immoral behavior have been regularly and violently assaulted. More news to Jir this week. Women's rights activists in Nicaragua are subjecting President Daniel Ortega to the tribunal of public opinion by reviving accusations of raping his stepdaughter in the 1980s. Time reports that Ortega is in the process of rehabilitating his image as a progressive and revolutionary leader. Ortega's stepdaughter has withdrawn her abuse case, but the protests will continue to grow. Nevada Governor Jim Gibbons is facing a civil lawsuit from a Las Vegas waitress who claims that he attacked and threatened to rape her while he was candidate for office. The waitress is seeking $10,000 in damages. Gibbons has denied the claims. A Chicago Tribune analysis found that only 1/6 of the 19,000 domestic violence cases in Illinois' Cook County results in convictions, leading victims to lose faith in the courts. Convictions in Chicago also dropped to 14% in 2007 from 20% in 2003. Sexual harassment is routine and the biggest fear for Pakistan female journalists, the Interpress Service reports. 14% of Pakistan Association of Television Journalists members are women. The Washington Post reports that Sierra Leone has the greatest risk of death in childbirth, with 1 in 8 mothers dying. Across the globe, more than 500,000 women a year die in childbirth, which is about 1 every minute. The London Telegraph reported that efforts to reform Northern Ireland's abortion laws were abandoned after officials warned that it could threaten ongoing peace negotiations between Catholic separatists and Protestant loyalists. Also noted in the news this week, women's health advocate and dean of the Mailman School of Columbia University, Alan Rosenfield, died on October 12th. Focusing his efforts on the HIV/AIDS pandemic, Rosenfield helped bring comprehensive healthcare to over 500,000 women and children through programs to prevent transmission of the virus from mother to infant. He worked for over 4 decades advocating for reproductive rights and family planning programs. Journalist, author, and women's rights activist June Levine died in Dublin on October 14th from a stroke. Levine took part in the fight against Ireland's ban on contraception. She was a strong voice in denouncing the harsh lives of prostitutes and participated in supporting rape victims. She wrote for the Irish Times and the RTE's Late Show, where she created a show about the women's movement and wrote books about her experience with movement sisters. These news briefs were compiled by Julia Anglehescu. Rita Henley Jensen is the editor-in-chief. Background music is by Joan Hickley. This production of Women's E-News is brought to you by VP Foundation and Yin Radio. This column and more news about women can be found at Women's E-News website, womensenews.org. For Yin Radio, I'm Anna Marai Roque.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
The fragile state of the world financial system has been laid bare, almost overnight it seems. Companies that dominated the financial landscape have disappeared, or been crippled. Credit has dried up, and stock markets have gyrated wildly, mostly downward. At least one whole country, Iceland, is suddenly at the verge of bankruptcy. Peak oil, and the following decline in world oil production, can bring about sudden changes as well. How much can the rapidity of the financial meltdown tell us about what to expect from peak oil? For one thing, when a crucial part of the world changes, things can fall apart very quickly. The ever-multiplying world supply of money created in the last 8 years or so has largely been built on one thing, rising U.S. home prices. A financial system was constructed around issuing ever more risky mortgages and selling the mortgages to other institutions. As long as home prices kept rising, more and more above historical trends, the system seemed to work. When the real estate market soured and the bubble started deflating, things fell apart. Throughout the financial system, people discovered that financial instruments previously thought to have real value were actually loaded with loans that have little or no chance of being repaid. And nobody knew how widespread the problem was. One key assumption changed, and the whole financial house of cards started collapsing. Of course, it's unreasonable to believe that home prices will forever inflate at higher than historical rates. It's also unreasonable to believe that extraction of a finite natural resource, oil, will continue to increase forever. Yet industrial society has been designed around the assumption that that's exactly what will happen. Like the financial system, the petroleum industry is what Yale sociologist Charles Perrow might call an accident waiting to happen. In his book Normal Accidents, Perrow points out that accidents are to be expected when systems are designed in two ways. One, they are so complex that not even their designers understand them. And two, they are so tightly coupled that failures in one area cascade through other parts of the system too rapidly for humans to comprehend them and respond. Perrow says that nuclear power plants, petrochemical plants, and aircraft are examples of systems set up to have what he's termed these normal accidents. As we've seen, the financial system is also too complex for any one person to understand, and it's so tightly coupled that failures in a few key players rapidly threaten to bring down the whole system. The globalized petroleum industry is also too complex for any one person to understand. The U.S., for example, imports oil and other petroleum products from around the world, but it also exports some petroleum products. And what's happening on any given day, no one really knows. With oil companies unable to increase oil supply, the systems are stretched thin, and any disruption can rapidly lead to problems like the weeks of gasoline shortages the Southeast has experienced following Hurricane Ike. Disruptions can trigger further disruptions as well. The Discovery Channel documentary We Were Warned described a fictional but plausible scenario in which a Category 5 hurricane takes out nearly all of the U.S. Gulf of Mexico oil production and refining capacity. Al-Qaeda then realizes that world oil supplies are stretched so tight that it's an optimal time to maximize the effect of a new terrorist crime. They hijack a plane and crash it into the Saudi processing facility at Abqaiq. They also attack two Saudi oil ports, taking 8% of world oil off the market in a few hours. The point is not whether such a scenario might happen as described. The point is that, as oil becomes more scarce relative to demand, it increases the potential benefits for actors who wish to create chaos to advance their cause. In real life, Russia responded to attacks on their peacekeepers by Georgian troops by invading Georgia and taking up positions along a strategic million-barrel-per-day oil pipeline from the Caspian Sea to the Black Sea. And local groups in Nigeria have increasingly kidnapped oil company personnel and sabotaged oil facilities in the Delta. The world is tightly interconnected, and, like the global financial system has proved to be, it's based on assumptions that cannot hold, like oil production will continue to grow. The way to prevent the sort of collapse we've seen in financial systems is to reduce the complexity of the systems and decouple them. In energy, that means using less energy, using it more effectively, using more locally renewable resources of energy, and introducing more redundancy into our energy strategies. It's an approach that puts resilience ahead of short-term economic gains for long-term economic benefit. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest.
This Week in Radical History for the week of October 20th. And starting on this date in 1832, the Treaty of Pontotoc Creek was forced upon the Chickasaw people, giving up 6 million acres. The preamble to the treaty reads, quote, "The Chickasaw Nation finds themselves opposed to their present situation by being made subject to the laws of the state in which they reside. Being ignorant of the language and laws of the white man, they cannot understand or obey them. Rather than submit to the great evil, they prefer to seek a home to the West, where they may live and be governed by their own laws." Also on October 20, 1916, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman is arrested for distributing birth control information and released on a $500 bond. Also on that date in 1918, the Anti-Anarchist Acts passed by Congress, granting the government authority to deport aliens living in the United States, and it would be the start of the Palmer Raids. During this exact same time in Russia, the Cheka secret police start to round up and imprison anarchists in Russia. Those pesky anarchists. Also on October 20, 1926, labor activist and anti-militarist and socialist Eugene Debs dies. His radical reforms include an 8-hour workday, pensions, workers' compensation, sick leave, Social Security, all commonplace today. He once ran for president from his jail, and he once wrote, "We propose to destroy the capitalist and save the man. We want a system in which the worker shall get what he produces, and the capitalist shall produce what he gets." Eugene Debs. Also on a date in 1973, the Saturday Night Massacre occurs when President Nixon's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, announces special Watergate prosecutor Cox is dismissed. In addition, he reports that Attorney General Richardson has resigned and Deputy Attorney General Ruckelshaus has been fired. Both of them, of course, did that because they would not dismiss Cox. Bush's Unitarian One Ruler as King loves the jibs of Nixon's cut. Also on this date in 1981, three members associated with the Weather Underground is arrested for the armed truck robbery. The Weather Underground took their name from this Bob Dylan song.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. A man in a trench coat, patch out laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen. $11 bills, you only got 10. Maggie calls Fleetfoot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bed, but phone stabbed anyway. Maggie says the minister must bust an early man. Orders from the DA. Look out, kid, don't matter what you did, but walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows, then stay away from those that care out of fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash your clean clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know it's where the wind blows. Oh, get sick, get well, hang around the inkwell. Hang bell, hard to tell if everything is on sale. Try hard, get boxed, get back, ride rail, get jail, jump bail. Join the army if you can. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit by losers, cheaters, sick-time users, hanging around the theaters, grilled by the whirlpools, looking for a new fool. Leaders, watch your parking meters. Oh, it gets boring, keep on, show pants, romance. Learn to dance, get dressed, get flipped. Try to be a success, please her, please him. Buy gifts, don't steal, don't rip. 20 years of schooling and they put you on a day shift. Look out, kid, they keep it all hid. Better jump down a manhole, light yourself a candle. Don't wear sandals, try to afford the scandal. Don't want to be a bum, you better chew gum. The pump don't work cause the vandals took the handle.
Also on this date in 1990, 22 cities hold anti-Gulf War rallies. A reporter would also ask U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright this question. We have heard that 500,000 children have died as a result of the sanctions in Iraq. I mean, that is more children that died than all of Hiroshima. And, you know, is the price worth it? Madeleine Albright responded, I think it was a very hard choice, but the price, woof, we feel the price was worth it. You know, it doesn't take a weatherman. This Week in Radical History for October 21st, 1837, at Fort Peyton, Florida, 75 Seminole chiefs are captured and imprisoned by U.S. during peace talks under the flag of truce called by the United States government. Also on October 1st, 1909, in the city of Brotherly Love, the police chief and other Philadelphia zealots guarding human and civil rights refuse to allow Emma Goldman to speak unless they can preview her speech.
Frank Rizzo, ex-police chief and mayor of Philadelphia, would say, "Yes, the streets are safe in Philadelphia. It's only the people who make them unsafe." Also on October 21, 1929, Ursula Le Guin is born. Science fiction fantasy novelist and anarchist. Her books include Dispossessed and Left Hand of Darkness. One of the best modern science fiction and fantasy authors, noted for exemplary style and her exploration of Taoist, anarchist, feminist philosophy and social themes. Quoting Ursula Le Guin from The Dispossessed, "You cannot buy a revolution. You cannot make the revolution. You can only be the revolution. It is in your spirit, or it is nowhere." Also on this day in October 21st, 1963, Attorney General Bobby Kennedy authorizes wiretaps of Martin Luther King's offices. Also on this date in 1967, Yippies, diggers, anarchists, and other high priests meet in Washington, D.C. for an exorcism of the Pentagon to rid the world of global evil spirit viruses affecting all who work there. The result was 647 arrests. God, it was only so easy. Ever wonder why the mail was so slow? Well, in 1973, Senator Church reveals that the CIA intercepted 28 million pieces of mail between 1953 and 1973. And under the Bush administration? And Bush's old man in 1988 says, "He hears the quiet people others don't." Well, comedian Albert Brooks was quoted saying, "I have friends in Los Angeles that hear quiet people that others don't, and he takes a lot of medication for it." This week in Radical History for October 22nd, 1856, U.S. forces land in Canton, China to protect the American interests. Also on October 22nd, 1887, American Red Revolutionary John Reed lives in Portland, Oregon. Author of 10 Days That Shocked the World, Chronicle of Mexico and the Soviet Revolutions. Though a native-born American, he was denied access back into his own country. Reed is the only American buried behind the Kremlin Wall in Red Square. Also on October 22, 1934, Depression-era outlaw Pretty Boy Floyd is killed. A folk hero to many people in Oklahoma who saw him as the sagebrush Robin Hood, stealing from rich banks and help the poor to eat and buy them groceries, and tearing up their mortgages during the bank robberies.
If you gather round me, people, the story I will tell about Pretty Boy Floyd and outlaw Oklahoma knew him well. Was in the town of Shawnee, was on his way to move his wife beside him in a wagon. And in the town they rode. Every damn Benny Sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude, using vulgar words of language. And his wife, she overheard. Honey boy grabbed the love chain and the deputy grabbed his gun, and in the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. And he took to the hills of timber to live the life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. There's many a starving farmer, the same old story told, how this old law paid the mortgage to save the little home. Others tell you of a stranger that come to beg a meal, and underneath a napkin left $1,000 bill. Was in Oklahoma City on the 5th of afternoon, from a whole carload of groceries, and a letter that did say, "You say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Well, here's a Christmas dinner the family's
on the leave." Last on in 1975, Air Force Technical Sergeant Leonard Matlovic, a decorated veteran of the Vietnam War, is given a general discharge by the Air Force after publicly declaring his homosexuality. In 1979, after winning a much-publicized case, his discharge is upgraded to honorable. 9 years later, at age 44, he dies and is buried in Congressional Cemetery in Washington, D.C., with a tombstone that reads, "A gay Vietnam veteran that gave me a medal for killing two men and discharged me for loving one." This week in Radical History for October 24th, 1871, rising anti-immigrant feelings and laws being passed, and a mob in Los Angeles on this date hangs 18 Chinese from the trees. Also on October 24, 1901 in Philippines, U.S. Marines land in Samar during the Philippine insurrection. U.S. Brigadier General Hell Roaring Jake Smith issues his orders, quote, "I wish you to burn and kill. The more you burn and kill, the better I'll be pleased," unquote. Also on this date in 1968, Yavapai Tribe of Arizona wins $5 million settlement for 9 million acres taken from them 194 years earlier. Well, better late than never, I guess. Also on this date in 1990 in Italy, the government publicly confirms revelations exposing Operation Gladio, a grouping of Western anti-communist intelligence agencies funded by the American CIA. These agencies, working in concert and funding neo-fascists, often use a strategy of state terrorism, particularly during the late 1960s, but all the way up through the 1990s. These included carrying out sensational kidnapping, murdering, disinformation, and bombing designed to appear to be work of left-wing groups. So again, the CIA sponsored right-wing terrorism groups in hopes of destabilizing countries and keeping them from going to the left. This week in radical history for October 25th, I only have a couple items. 1806, in Germany, philosopher Max Stirner lives, theorist of individualist anarchism, opposed to Karl Marx. He once wrote, "The great are great only because we are on our knees. Let us rise." Also on this date in 1862, another anarchist thinker, Ernest Corduroy, commits suicide. This quote of his fits well in today's realities as well. "In the shadow of the cruel and ridiculous spectacle arises the old war of the poor against the rich, which today, masked and falsified by ideological refraction, is the war of the poor who wants to stay poor and the poor who wants to stop being poor." Lastly, on this date in 1960, Martin Luther King Jr., jailed in Decatur, Georgia, held over on old traffic ticket charges, denied bail, and sentenced to 4 months of hard labor. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Gleegly Studios. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer, and radical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. As the elections draw near, here's a little short philosophy from George Carlin.
"Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, 'Joe, I voted.'"
Amen, brother. So until next week's This Week in Radical History, I am forever yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon. I'll leave you now with some Ghost Mice.
What have we done? What have we done? Are we making any changes or just having fun? What have we done? What have we done? Is this more than just music? Is it more than just a club? Are we making any difference? Oh, what have we done? What have we done? What have we done? Well, just take a look around, and I'm sure that you'll agree that we've done a lot of things to improve community, like organizing protests and serving food, not bombs, sending books to all the prisoners that have been locked up for so long, throwing bricks through all the windows of the evil corporate shops, supporting mom and pop and standing up to the murdering racist cops. Seems like we're always talking about things we do wrong, but let's not forget to talk about the good things that we've done. Well, no, we've got our faults, and I must say that I agree, but punk rock music saved my life. I can sing it honestly. Sometimes it may seem like we haven't done anything, but I think that we made it a little bit better than it was. That's why I sing, and I'll ask you to sing with me.
Up the punks, up the punks, up the punks. Up the punks, up the punks, up the punks. Up the punks, up the punks, up the punks. Up the punks, up the punks, up the punks.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard Mondays from 2 to 6.
I'm with another gentleman here who's at the anti-Nazi protests. And I
this is Mike Cannon. I'm with Becca, who has returned from Palestine for the fourth time.
I'm with a vendor at the energy fair here who has biodiesel.
This is Mike Cannon. I'm with a group, the RNC Welcoming Committee for the Republican National Convention that's going to be coming up.
Need is still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times fold that in huge swaths of this town, like in the 9th Ward, where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So
stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
And you too can stay current by checking out the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show, normally heard every Monday from 2 to 6 p.m. on this, your only not-for-profit, commercial-free community radio station, 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.